somebody. I mean, I'm not putting forward practical policy advice, right? I mean, the question is, what are we for? If I can agree to convince you what we should be for, then in various circumstances, in America, in Nazi Germany, in the slave South, you know, in the secular, the most secular society on earth today, we can talk about what's practical. In some situations, people who have the right the right moral principles should hide. You know, I'm not saying, I don't think it automatically falls into the fact that I say we should do something stupid that will make the situation worse from the standpoint of our values. That's just a completely different discussion, a long discussion, and it has to be, you know, in a context and get, you know, we need to put some frame around what we're actually talking about as to what sorts of practical policies or implications in given circumstances would follow from whatever principles we together decide are right, and what we can do in a world where some people are against us, some people could be convinced, some people are going to be trying to reinstitute slavery if they can. Where the answer begins with, well, it depends on what the balance of power is, and there may be a kind of modus vivendi. Someone might imagine somebody put forward a doctrine of neutrality on the right in the 19th century in America in terms of slavery, and then someone pops up and says, but look, slaves have rights. We shouldn't be neutral on the right. Slaves have rights. And someone says, but look, given the distribution of political preferences and the views of the right, 98% of Americans either own slaves or believe that owning slaves is right. So, and I can sympathize with their views, given that they come from tongues and so on. I'm not saying, maybe in the old South, I mean, who knows what we should do, what the right, but nonetheless, I say, I haven't made the argument, I'm being more abstract, but again, just as I would say, within the theory of the right, whatever, the opinion poll in the South in the 1850s is, I still think slaves have rights, and whatever the opinion poll, for God's sakes, in America and in other countries as well, Sri Lanka, wherever, that isn't an argument for what the right conception of sexuality is. I haven't begun to try to give any arguments. I just invited you to think. I mean, do you really think that same sex isn't as good as opposite sex sex? I haven't made any arguments. But I just invite you to think that this is a plausible case where, if you can't get state power, and if the attempt to get state power makes things worse, vote for the Thomists or hide in the closet, whatever. I haven't said anything about practical politics. The question is just, what should we be for?
So your major question was roughly the following, that I, especially in the original version paper, but also to some extent in today's version, treat fairness as a constraint on the kinds of accommodations that ought to be granted, something that limits the accommodations. And in doing so, there's a certain amount of deference to the sorts of arguments that Brian Barry makes, whereas you have less patience for Barry's arguments and think that we make fairness arguments all the time in favor of accommodations, and give some examples of emergency vehicles and so forth. But I guess I would just ask two questions about that, about those exemptions. One is, are they morally required, or are they things that are permissible but not required? Probably they are morally required to hit the emergency vehicles, but there's lots and lots of exemptions on the books in law, which are just kind of put there by town councils and legislatures and so forth, and we wouldn't think that they're wrong, but we also wouldn't think that it's wrong not to have them there. I'm interested in the question of whether certain kinds of exemptions are morally required and not just morally permissible. In particular, and this is sort of the second question I've asked, is it required for exemptions to be made in the case of burdens that are not medical, for example, in nature, or houses on fire, or people being mugged, but that are commitment-based, that have to take the form of somebody not being able to fulfill certain kinds of commitments that are important to them. So I guess I'm not clear what the fairness argument in favor of accommodations would look like unless it's either the non-discrimination argument, which I just discussed in the talk, but perhaps not in so much detail in the original version, or unless the point is that it's unfair to make a law that's burdensome on someone's ability to fulfill their conscience, in which case that's kind of the heart of the priority view, so we wouldn't really disagree, we'd just be using somewhat different, we'd be using abstract words like fairness to describe some of these are in different ways, but agreeing on the substantive position.
Yes, thanks for your comments, Joe. One thing, I guess, when you describe my work as a development of Berlin, that's true. But sometimes people have the impression, whenever I mention Berlin, that I'm trying to just interpret what he said. I don't think you were accusing me of this, but I just mentioned this as an aside. Sometimes that's what people expect. When in fact, I'm certainly inspired by Berlin, and I draw a lot from him. Is my starting point, but I think there's a major flaw in his political thought, which is that he didn't do anything to reconcile the pluralist component of his thought on the one hand with the liberal component on the other, and that's in part what I'm trying to do. Although when I say reconcile, I also want to acknowledge remaining tensions between those ideas and between the various values that need to be talked about in this connection. So in that connection, liberalism is a constellation of values that are in tension with one another rather than a coherent package. I certainly wouldn't want to deny that. Yes, there are tensions between the different goods that liberalism stands for, that's right. It's saying that liberalism can present a more or less coherent package of goods in opposition to rival packages. I don't mean that the goods are harmonious in any way. Yes, there are tensions between them. I just think the tensions can be, at least within bearable limits, resolved, sufficient for the purposes of presenting a persuasive political argument. Liberalism is presented as above the fray on this view. That is a phrase from Charles Taylor. On the one hand, I'd say no, I wouldn't hold my hand up to that one, because I have presented liberalism as, in a sense, being on the same level from a pluralist point of view as other views, in that, like other views, it presents and defends a certain ranking of goods, universal goods and other goods. So it's like other political views in that respect, and that's one reason why I think the view I've defended is rather closer to perfectionism than it is to neutrality. On the other hand, I think liberalism has more going for it than its rivals have on this view, for various reasons. And the pluralist arguments that I've given are just some of those. I don't say those are the only ways of defending liberalism at all. There are many ways of defending liberalism. But the way I got into this whole issue was taking up the cudgels with people like John Gray, who were arguing that if you're a pluralist, you cannot be a liberal. So I was confronted by people who wanted to use value pluralism as a stick to beat liberals over the head with. And what I've been trying to do is to show that, in fact, you can turn the tables on that kind of argument and present liberalism as not only compatible with pluralism, but actually present pluralism as a possible foundation for liberalism. So, in a sense, a fighting creed, but one that can do better than most in the battle.
Okay, so now we'll open up to questions. I was going to say, just in terms of time, I find this room very easy to slip out of discreetly, and so it seems to me that we can go for a half an hour and people who need to leave can just leave. Does that Sunday symbol? Yeah. I look to authority figures. There aren't any. So, all right, let's start. And also use your mics and say who you are before asking your question.
I'm going to turn yours off, George.
Come on, okay, just keep the hands up.
I'm Colin McLeod. I have two quick questions. One for, if that's permissible. I don't know if that's permissible. I'm not trying to fall prey to Alan's.
don't give up the floor.
one to Alan and one to George. The question to Alan has to do with the formulation of the neutrality condition. And I mean, in one sense, I'm very sympathetic to your advocacy of the priority view. But I wonder if the way you formulated the neutrality condition is going to make that whole view fail too easily. So you said something like, the intention must not be to disfavor or impede particular conscientious activities or something like that, right? So I take it that if it is intended to impede some activity, then that fails the test, and so much the worse for that. But it seems to me that at least in a range of cases, legislative intent is precisely to impede these activities, right? I mean, and the case that I have in mind, just because it's the sort of thing I work on, is cases involving children, right? You say, oh, we're going to impede your ability to adhere to your religious convictions with respect to how you think your children should be treated better, or how they should be educated, right? And, I mean, it's transparent. That's what the intention of these things is, to stop people doing certain things. Right? Your priority view catches that just fine, right? You say, we have a substantial interest in ensuring the well-being of children or the education of children, so yes, you can do all your religious practices except deny them blood transfusions or inoculations or primary education and so on, right? But, I mean, it looks to me like an honest description of what happens sometimes in these legislative cases. You're just trying to say, we're going to stop people with certain kinds of religious motivations acting on, well, not only religious motivations, but whatever it happens to be, right? I'm not quite sure how that should be handled. For George, I guess my question is, you said at the end that your view was compatible with a relaxed version of liberal neutrality. It seems to me so relaxed that there's no neutrality left. I mean, being sympathetic to the idea that there are these range of universal goods and that they should be valued and promoted, I would expect that you would be in favor of a quite highly perfectionist state that went around identifying and promoting and ensuring the existence of a range of valuable activities, not by trampling on people's autonomy, right, but by saying, when they come to the state and say, hey, we've got this valuable activity list, we're having a hard time maintaining our language, our bowling alley, our tapestry club, the diverse forms of human sexual relations, you know, if you would help us out, promote it, subsidize us, we'd be better off. And there'd be more of these valuable forms of life and activities instantiated. So shouldn't your view, the celebration and promotion of genuine human goods, favor not neutrality, where the state's supposed to say, oh, I don't know, we shouldn't be making these controversial judgments about what's sort of valuable and what's not valuable. Shouldn't it favor the identification and active promotion, which doesn't seem, it may be attractive or unattractive, but it sure doesn't seem like liberal neutrality.
Thanks a lot. I've struggled a bit with this question, thinking about it. I'm not sure I really have a very good answer, but I mean, I guess the standard way that people who discuss neutrality think about this is they'll take a case like an animal slaughter regulation, and say that one rationale why a legislature might adopt such a regulation is because they want to stop some particular religious group that's engaging in a particular form of slaughter from doing that slaughter. That would count as non-neutral in my terms. But another kind of rationale would be that they care about animal welfare or public health or something like that. That would have the same effect of stopping the group from acting on its conscientious convictions. But if we tried to sort of get to the bottom of why they were doing this, we would go beyond stopping that group from following its convictions to this more bedrock rationale, which is the public. So I think that would work for the examples that, something like that would work for the examples that you mentioned of blood transfusions and educating children and so forth. The point of those laws is not to the sort of final rationale for those laws is not to stop particular groups from engaging particular practices. It's to because the laws apply beyond those groups, right? But it's to require all parents to protect their children's health in certain ways or provide education in certain kinds of ways. But anyways, that's the thought.
Okay, so once I figure this is the end way, any kind of challenge, why not strong perfectionism?
I guess I could accept that in a way. Why shouldn't the state promote lots of goods rather than simply stay out of the picture? I mean, if that could be done in a fair way, that was respectful of all the different values and the different combinations of them, I guess that's fair enough. The only thing is, I think among the various principles that I propose, the reasonable disagreement principle may tell a little bit against that. If several different conceptions of the good can be regarded as on an equal footing as regards people's capacity to disagree on reasonable grounds about whether they should be pursued or not, perhaps more sensible response to the state would be to stay out of the picture in that respect. I mean, with that side of things, I think I have a bit more sympathy than Dick had with the idea of different conceptions of the good being on a par as being only sort of partly justifiable.
Can I ask, I'm just not sure, but if we, there are plural values, but this incommensurability, we can't say if we have for combinations of more and less. Suppose there's grapes, karate, and poetry, but we can't say for any combinations whether this combination is better than that. Then I don't see why it's any worse. If we could get a certain amount of karate, and if we get more than zero of the other values, then the amount of karate drops. I don't see why we should be for more values rather than less in that world. I mean, the world where there's 10 units of karate, and if we had any grapes or any poetry, that would reduce the amount of karate. It seems to me if you can't do any commensurability, then you can't say that state of affairs is worse than the state of affairs in which there's a little bit less karate and some poetry. I mean, or put it the other way, that if you are allowing that, no, we should be for more values, the world in which there's both, in which karate and poetry and grapes all flourish, that's the better world, then there is some commensurability, partial commensurability, you know, partially with a partially rubber yardstick, but not infinitely stretchable or something. So I'm just a puzzle. Maybe I haven't quite got the
key yet. Well, it is a problem. Well, I guess if you take up the coherence side of what you're saying, you may depend on what you can combine with what, and maybe larger amounts of one good rather than another. Maybe that's the optimal policy, depending on what it can be combined with. I'm not sure what else to say about that.
Well, we have lots of questions, so why don't we go to the very back there.
My name is Will Roberts, I'm at McGill. And this is in some sense, I think it's going to follow on the heels of Dick Arnson's question for George Crowder. I wanted to ask you to expand a little bit on what you mean by practical reason, because I'm confronted by the following problem. If goods are essentially plural, and incommensurable, conceptions of the good life are schemes for ranking basic human goods, then on what basis can you say that many such general rankings will be prima facie reasonable, since it seems like in the face of incommensurability, all such rankings would be unreasonable by definition. And you also say that pluralism does not imply indifference because it requires choosing amongst incommensurables for a reason. And I want to push you to say a little bit more about what counts as a reason in this case.
All right, so well, first question was that all attempts to rank goods are unreasonable from a pluralist point of view. Well, I think that attempts to rank goods in the abstract or absolutely are unreasonable. But that still leaves open the possibility of having good reasons to rank goods in particular cases. That's one thing. But also, I think it also leaves open the possibility of having at least some reason to rank goods across, as I put it, across a generality of cases, that is, across some range of cases or across most cases. And as this is the way I think of it, that's the sort of thing that that people do when they put forward a conception of the good. They're not claiming that in every single possible situation their preferred goods must come first. They're saying that in some generality of cases, Christian humility or whatever it is should be stressed or emphasized. And I think that's compatible with the pluralist view. That makes sense?
Yeah, possibly. I'm not sure. I guess to some extent, I suppose it would involve getting down to the nitty-gritty of what counts as, you know, concrete circumstances and what sorts of choices we're concerned with. But I'm still not certain. I guess you use this term of practical reason, which makes me think of Aristotle, but I have no, and you talk about this, the concrete particulars of circumstances, which again makes me think of Aristotle, but I'm not sure what sort of reasoning you're thinking we engage in.
That's the kind of model I was thinking of,
okay.
Aristotle. Right? So in that part of it, I'm more or less following some of the early work of Martha Nussbaum, who I think makes a connection between this kind of pluralist view and practical reasoning, phrases type reasoning in concrete cases. That's how I think of it. But choices among conflicting plural values in particular concrete cases, that's one side of the problem. What I was talking about today and what I probably spent most of my time on is connecting up a pluralist view with a political framework within which the concrete reasoning can take place. So that's where the arguments about liberalism come. But you're right, I haven't said that much about what exactly practical reasoning would be like under pluralism. But very, very roughly speaking, something like an Aristotelian model is what I have in the back of my mind. Yep.
I have a question for Alan. I wonder whether there would be a role or a play, some room in your framework for concept of indirect discrimination, because you mentioned that discrimination is one of the principles according to the in the second uniformal view. But I wonder, it seems to me that it has to play a role too within the first view, the priority view that you defend, quite rightly, I think. I'm thinking here that in the Canadian jurisprudence on religious accommodation, the court said that the duty to accommodate kicks in only when it has been demonstrated that there is indirect discrimination in effect. So there's a rule or law that is that doesn't directly discriminate against any members of any minority groups or whatever. But when you apply the general rule, it does indirectly discriminate against members of a religious group or and so on. And it's it's only in the in these cases that the duty to accommodate applies, and there's no room for such a concept in the Scalia slash Berry view. And so far as the rule is prima facie a neutral, well, there's no obligation to accommodate, and all these the claims amount to expensive tastes. But it seems to me that even in the priority view, we need maybe a richer concept of discrimination.
Thanks. I started with the model from American discrimination law of so-called adverse impact, which is has kind of the same structure as the what I'm calling the priority view. So that's when a company or an employer adopts a set of regulations, say relating to promotion or workplace in some way, which are facially neutral, but which have a disproportionately burdensome impact on certain designated and protected groups, and the approach that gets worked out in some of the cases, the court cases, says that it prohibits that kind of adverse impact unless the company can show that there's a business necessity, right? So that would be roughly the analog of the idea that you can't adversely impact the liberty to fulfill conscientious obligations unless there's some appropriately strong justification. So I very much sort of thinking in those terms.
The guy in front of me.
Hi, my name is Chris Durante. I had a question for Dr. Crowder. It seems pluralism has to be comprised of contingency of pluralists. So what does a group who won't subscribe to pluralism do in the face of this? Can they be part of this pluralistic society or this pluralistic view? Does it accommodate a group who isn't willing to accept pluralism as their ultimate value, that wants to remain themselves and maybe even withdrawn from other communities, but wants to uphold their own negative liberties and not being impeded upon by other people, such as groups of liberals or groups of pluralists, as you describe pluralists, or even other more traditional societies?
Yeah, I'm not sure I'm saying that everyone ought to be a pluralist. My argument is that if pluralism is true, then it logically has these various implications. One of them being, you know, this case I tried to make for the value of autonomy, individual autonomy. And you know, that would be true if there were no pluralists at all, since pluralism is a claim about the deep nature of moral value, which could be true even if no one actually believed it. So. I'm not making an argument that everyone ought to be a pluralist. And in fact, maybe there is a kind of odd or paradoxical kind of argument that from a pluralist point of view, it might be a good thing if your society contains some people who are not pluralists, some monists, at least you know, preferably liberal monists like J.S. Mill or someone, who you know, have a different view of value, and so. And gave you an extra dimension, different dimension on how to look at that. And perhaps as a result of how, to some extent, of how to live. So, I'm not sure that I'm requiring everyone to be a pluralist.
Okay. Also, if I could follow up
briefly.
Okay. You said you're not going to focus so much on cultural pluralism as much as values. What happened in cases of religion, as was here in Quebec, or you know, or in many, many modern contemporary societies such as England and London and New York, where there are various religio-cultural traditions coming together? How do you see your theory addressing that on a very practical, pragmatic level of enabling people to to coexist more peacefully. I mean, when it seems that you don't really want to address the deep cultural value parts, or it's not just value but belief system, so people they can't do away with it as easily, or it's harder to play with.
Well, it's not that I don't want to address cultural pluralism. I think I do want to address it. What I say is that on the pluralist view, it's goods or values that the primary focus for this argument, rather than whole cultures, which are kind of on this view sort of secondary phenomena that are constructed out of combinations of goods and values. And the practical consequence of that is that this separates a pluralist view from a relativist view, which makes cultures and other sorts of perspectives, including religious perspectives, authoritative, morally authoritative, whereas on a pluralist view, my argument is that they are not authoritative, but more general arguments that focus on values primarily can be used to criticize both cultural commitments and religious commitments as well. How is all this going to help different groups of cultural allegiances or religious allegiances to live together peacefully? Well, my rough answer is that what enables that to happen is the kind of liberal framework that that I think can be justified on pluralist grounds.
This question is for Dick. It's related to something that Joe asked. One of your objections to Rawls' idea of political liberalism is that you understand it is giving people with reasonable, minimally rational, comprehensive conceptions, comprehensive doctrines, a kind of veto over the ideal conception of justice. You seem to say, look, the question about whether the, you know, what's the best conception of justice, the one that's most rationally defensible, that's the one we should go with, even if it's inconsistent with some minimally rational comprehensive doctrine. And I understand the force of that criticism. I just want to suggest that it's maybe not quite as decisive as you're suggesting, because I think that the way Rawls was conceiving of it, he's assuming that any sort of defensible conception of justice is going to be a fundamentally liberal one, protect basic rights and basic interests and so forth, and that so that justice is going to require a conception of justice like that, and it's going to be liberal in the broad outline. So the real question is there any basis to decide between different liberal conceptions? And I think one of the points he was trying to make is that a liberal conception of justice that can be the object of an overlapping consensus, because it's not a comprehensive liberalism, is better from the point of view of justice than a comprehensive liberalism that cannot be the object of an overlapping consensus. The fact that a liberal conception of justice, is acceptable in the overlapping consensus sense to everyone is a moral argument in its favor over a liberal conception of justice that has roughly the same content, but is a comprehensive liberalism, and so is not acceptable to people in virtue of their reasonable comprehensive doctrines.
You may be overstating the extent to which I'm criticizing. I mean, I like the setup of the problem, right? I mean, forget, you know, that. If we look around, we see there are these, you know, comprehensive doctrines. It seems as though, given just minimal free speech and non-tyranny, which is what we're all going to want to accept, that situation of people fanning out into allegiance to non-crazy, non-retarded, normal, in some sense reasonable people, fanning out into allegiance to various comprehensive conceptions of the good, and then the sense that it would be sectarian to appeal to any one of those as the basis for social unity and the terms we can live by. So then you've got the idea. So I like that. And then the idea is, well, then we need to think about in terms of reasons we can share a public conception of justice something that, that responds to that problem, and the reasons are reasons designed to produce a conception of terms of social cooperation given that background, given that problem. I like all that. I just don't see that that rules out, you know, at the level of what goes in, controversial conceptions of the good any more than controversial conceptions of the right. They seem all on a par. And it seems to me there's two notions that here. One notion is the notion of public reason or reasons that we can share. And then the question, and then I think Rawls has kind of a downbeat interpretation of that as the kind of common sense stuff, lowest common denominator in the public culture, given the moral progress we have a hunch has existed in constitutional democracy. But you might but that you might leave that aside and only partly accept that. But there's this notion of given the starting problem of, you know, we've got these comprehensive doctrines that disagree, what are we going to do? How are we going to live together? And the notion of, you know, public reasons, reasons that we can put forward and genuinely see as reasons that any of us should be able to accept when we think about it. That's a standard justification in itself. The overlapping consensus idea, it's at least open that at the end of the day, going through this public reason, think about our perfect conception of justice, lo and behold, what we come up with is in conflict with my comprehensive doctrine for this world. But the project can still be a success. We still get a conception of justice that's supported by reason and that, you know, that can be acceptable to all. If then we went back to the comprehensive doctrines and I said, look, there's something in my evangelical Christianity or my Arnesonian militant atheism that doesn't go along with that, but I recognize it. It seems to me that it's the comprehensive doctrine that we have to give at that point to go along with the outcome of this public reasons process. So it seems to me, I like the setup. I like the idea of public reason and the idea of a limited purpose notion of justice as a response to this. And so it's reasons that we can, for this purpose and in response to this problem. And it seems to me that's the overlapping consensus idea, given the way you set it up, and given the idea that we wanted the comprehensive doctrines not to be, we don't want to define the standard of rationality so that they disappear. Given that, I don't see why. It would be great, it seems to me, if you got a lot of consensus. But it seems to me, the enterprise can be a success without that was the point. I thought of myself as sort of going along with political liberalism project, which I thought I had previously been kind of puzzled by. So you may come in. Is that a response?
I thought you were saying, and maybe I missed it, I thought you were saying that the goal of achieving overlapping consensus is a problematic goal because the best conception of justice might be inconsistent with some reasonable comprehensive doctrine. I thought you were, am I wrong to think that you're arguing
no,
that?
No. I mean, if it happened, you might just think, well, Rawls thinks that as a matter of fact, the right conception of justice, i.e. my Rawlsian justice is fairness, will in fact attract an overlapping consensus of, in my sense, my Rawlsian is reasonable doctrines. So you think that as a matter of fact it works out.
I haven't actually
said that's a challenge. So.
I have only three more, we can squeeze them in. So you can come to have a beer with us. Steve.
Okay, well, this is also a question for Arnesen. And it's on the issue of the possibility of disagreement between rational persons. So the coherence of equally rational persons holding opposed beliefs, right? So this is a claim in particular I thought was interesting, I wanted to ask you about. But you say, is what I cannot sensibly do is think that we could both be rational to adhere to different and opposed beliefs on the basis of what is now the same body of evidence once we share our reasons, right? So I guess first I kind of think about some philosophical disagreements, and then maybe there are political analogs to this. I'm not sure how it would extend, but some philosophical disagreements seems to me both parties are sort of equally competent philosophy, and they know this, so they know each other. They both have the intellectual virtues to the same degree. And they also have access to the same body of evidence, and they've heard all the arguments on both sides. Maybe it's free will, you have a compatibilist and an incompatibilist, right? So there it seems like there's temptation to say that we have something like a disagreement between equally rational persons, because there's no story either party can tell that doesn't just beg the question in favor of their view. I mean, they can say you're missing something, you're failing to weigh the considerations properly, because you're getting the wrong answer, right? But that's just assuming that they've got it right. So I'm thinking in those cases, another possibility is both parties just suspend belief, right? That they might say, well, look, if you're just as good at this as I am, and we can't agree, maybe there's no good case for belief either way. But that's not what typically happens in philosophical disagreement. We usually think it's rational to keep on believing. And yet it seems like there what we... The thing to say is that we've got here a genuinely rational disagreement between equally rational persons. In a way, I put myself in that shoes, and I think if I really came to believe that, I might think I was right by good fortune on this time. You know, it's not like I had any better something, anything I can point to, any intellectual obligation I'm satisfied better than my opponent. But I still think I'm right. So if you laugh at that kind of possibility, we're talking about free will.
I mean, there's a think of free will. I mean, there's a claim here that I made in a sentence that you might want to challenge. But the claim is that, I mean, so really part of what goes on with free will or indeterminism is that people, I mean, people understand each other's arguments and they give different weight to different arguments. And I think the argument that I won, you know, that's the crucial argument, because the opponent thinks the opposite. But then presumably there's the same issue is going to arise about standards for weight. If I have a certain view A about weighting arguments, you have another view B. But if there's just as much that can be said in favor of your view as mine, and then I recognize that, it seems to me I should be alienated in thought from my own, and I suppose we could keep going up, but in fact, you know, it kind of just kind of fades. So it seems to me there should be alienation from one's own beliefs once you, and I think in fact, people who, you know, partisans of athletes, you know, someone say soccer is good and American football is crummy, and someone else says American football is crummy, you know. And you think, you know, you think in some sense some of these disagreements and sort of aren't real disagreements in the sense that, you know, I know that whatever I can say on behalf of American football, the partisan of soccer can come up with further arguments and it's going to turn out to be a kind of standoff. And I know that it's just that I was raised in a certain community where my mother beat me up to make me play football. If I'd been raised in Australia, soccer or Latin America, I would. So once I see that, it seems to me, I mean, I might still have, so to speak, the emotional attachment and something belief-like, but is it really belief that football is superior given that?
Folks in philosophy all the time persist in holding the belief, even though they're willing to recognize that their opponents aren't making any mistake that they can identify, other than simply you're not weighing the considerations the way that I weigh them and the way I think they ought to be weighed. And then they have no further story about why they would be a better judge of this issue than the other person. So that's acknowledged, but that doesn't lead us to abandon our views and say, there's nothing to know. Neither side has a case.
I mean, two points. One point is, just, as this matter of sociology, you're right, but that might just not be normative. But partly, I think, think of the analogy in science. You know, there'll be a period of time that might be 5 years, 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, when we're not sure, we need to work on different ideas. And it's better if the people who are working on theory A and competing theory B have some emotional investment in it. And that goes along with something quasi-belief, you know, some commitment that's belief-like. But I think that's really consistent with standing back at the end of the day and saying, yes, I've spent my life betting on theory A, but, you know, look, I've read the articles in Physical Review. Do I really think that, you know, theory B, let's say that string theory, you know, won't eventually, we don't know yet. It's too early to tell. Yeah, that was the claim.
Andrew.
Hi, Andrew Lister. Question for Alan. So in response to the unfairness objection, you made two basic responses, the unfairness of accommodation. One was just that, well, some of these accommodations actually just involve greater equal liberty for everyone. This was the Greenwald case of the military, where we just say everybody can not serve if they're willing to do 3 years, and there's no unfairness. And the second one was, I guess, was essentially a baseline challenge when, you know, with the cafeteria example, you say, well, all I'm looking for here is what you already have, which is the ability to eat lunch and not have to violate your conscience. And so I guess Joe's point was that, well, where's the priority view? What work is a priority doing there? It just sounds like fairness plus the other two. So I was thinking, well, couldn't there be a response? Couldn't I respond to this, the cafeteria example? You know, whose responsibility is it here? I mean, I don't have a conscientious view about what kinds of food I eat, so I don't actually care about having the ability to eat lunch and not violate my conscience. I just don't have those kinds of views about right and wrong and eating food. That's your problem. That's your view of the good life. It's your expensive taste. I you know, don't blame me. You're free to have your funny view about food, but it's not my problem. And so, with that expensive taste objection, isn't it there that you have to defend the priority view, which is to say, no, there's something important. You know, there's these three things, as you mentioned, about conscience-based concern. Isn't that where you have to sort of confront the expensive taste objection?
I think the expensive taste objection is only an objection if there's an implied claim about unfairness and implied. So you can't just say that your ethical preference is a taste and therefore it's of no concern to me. I think you have to, in order for it to parallel the expensive taste objection, you have to show that granting the preference would somehow invade the fair share of others, which is how Barry looks at actually. Explicit about that structure, but then I need a story about why it would be unfair to design the menu in such a way as to have a number of different menu offerings so that people are not forced to choose between accepting the benefit and violating their conscience. So there needs to be some story about why that's unfair that kind of parallels Barry's implicit story about why equality of resources is the right to be referenced.
Can I just ask?
We've tried everyone's
okay.
So, thank you to the presenters.